Hello, you, and welcome to You Are Good, a Feelings podcast about movies. Today, we are talking about Best in Show, and we are talking about it with our great friend, Sarah Archer. I am one of your hosts, Alex Steed, and I will soon be joined by my marvelous co-host, Sarah Marshall. Best in Show is a 2000 American mockumentary comedy film co-written by Christopher Guest and Eugene Levy and directed by Guest. You know about it. It's the dogs. It's the dogs one. It's the dogs Christopher Guest movie. Sarah Archer is an American writer and curator based in Philadelphia. She's the author of Catland, The Soft Power of Cat Culture in Japan, The Mid-Century's Kitchen, America's Favorite Room, and more. We love Sarah Archer so much. She's been here before. She's written for Architectural Digest, of course, The New Yorker, Huffington Post, American Craft, and Slate, among others. You Are Good, if you're new to this whole thing, is what we call a feelings podcast about movies. We talk about movies, but we are not film critics necessarily. We just talk about the movies and how they illustrate the ways that we and other people relate to the world. We talk about feelings. We talk about sometimes mental healthy things, sometimes just like what the movie speaks to in us. And we have a good time doing it. So again, if you're new, welcome. We're happy that you're here. How are you doing? What is going on in your world? How are you feeling? What are you thinking about? What are you watching? Let us know. You can find You Are Good at You Are Good or You Are Good Pod, depending on which of the networks we're on social media. Let me know what you're reading. Let me know what the climate is like where you are. I mean, I understand the bigger climate picture, but what is this week like for you out of doors? What's it look like out there? I'm in Los Angeles, California. We're in the 70s right now. We're getting into the 80s real soon. I'm looking at all sorts of beautiful flora. And, you know, if you haven't heard this sort of thing lately, I hope you don't forget that you, my friend, are good. You Are Good, a feelings podcast about movies, is made possible with and by your support. Thanks to everyone who supports us on Patreon or Apple Podcast subscriptions. You get bonus episodes by supporting us. You help make the show possible. That's important. We appreciate it. We can't do it without support. It makes this part of our jobs, and we appreciate that that is on the table for us. And again, in exchange for that support, you get bonus episodes. We have a bonus episode about Mannequin 2 coming up this month that we recorded with River Butcher. We already have one out about Mannequin 1. This one is about Mannequin 2. We've got some other bonus content coming up for you. Our last one was about The Iron Claw. We've got a lot going on. If you, like me, are an advocate for ceasefire, please find ways to get involved locally or in your community. And if you're looking for ways to offer material support to help alleviate some hardship, you can look into the Palestine Children's Relief Fund. And we'll have that linked in the show notes. I don't know. I think that's it for this intro. Let's keep it short and sweet so we can go talk about dogs and laughing. Two of the most important things, as far as I'm concerned, dogs, laughing. These are the things that keep me going. Again, thanks for being here. We appreciate you. We're glad we get to do this with you. Let's get into it, shall we? Hello, Sarah Marshall.
Hello, Alex Steed. Do you want me to sing you your favorite song?
Yes, I do.
They buried William in the old churchyard. They buried Barbara beside him. Sarah, please join in if you want. And from
his grave grew a red, red rose. And out of his a briar. No, don't stay up too late. Don't stay up all night.
Don't stay up all night watching old movies.
Old movies, Tyrone.
Sarah, what's on our agenda? What's on the plate today? What's in the bowl?
Well, it's some Yukonuba dog food because we are talking about Best in Show, one of the most quotable movies of the last 25 years, and we're doing it with Sarah's in stereo because we have Sarah Archer back.
Hello.
Yay. Hello, Sarah.
What an absolute delight. So nice to be back.
Sarah, if you were a show dog, what kind would you be, do you think?
Oh gosh, that's such a good question. That's such a good question. I want to say not the sporting group. probably a toy of some kind who, you know, maybe like poised, yeah, but not totally coordinated.
Maybe a Cavalier King Charles. I mean, that's not a toy, but you know.
But kind of in the same ballpark. That seems, yeah, about right. Like able to kind of get up to a trot in the park, but like that's pretty much where, you know, where it stops.
Smarshal, what's yours?
If I were a show dog.
Sounds like the beginning of a song.
Yeah. Well, I would love to be like a Shih Tzu like Agnes in this movie, who's just forever being carried around by Scott Donlan.
I mean, that's the move, to be carried, yeah, around everywhere by Scott, yeah, Donlan, or anybody really, but Scott Donlan in particular.
I do. Yeah. I mean, that's my first choice. And then my safety is being carried around by everybody. I like to think I have a terrier spirit, you know, although I certainly don't work as hard as a terrier, but I get scared when the doorbell rings.
Very sensible.
Yeah. I think that I would be like a little Jack Russell. I would be in the terrier group and I would be a little bit too high strung. But I would do better with agility. Not that I'm agile as a human, but as a dog, I think my nervous energy would fit with that, you know, because we would have different lives as dogs. Alex, what about you?
I think that I would be one of those bearded terriers, like a Scottish terrier, but like one of the ones that you're surprised to find out isn't as smart as you thought it would be.
Like a Schnauzer. I mean, that's different, but they have a big beard.
I'm thinking like very specifically of like the little Monopoly guy, but like bigger.
Like a Scotty dog?
Yeah.
Little Scotty. Yeah. He's the Monopoly guy.
Aww. We're talking today about dogs. Some are big, some are small, some are even smaller. Some with coats so silky they look like they were woven by a giant spider. And we're talking about the people who take care of the dogs. And boy, how to introduce Best in Show.
Well, I'm curious about why, Sarah Archer, you picked this movie to bring into the conversation.
I was actually amazed that you guys hadn't done it yet.
Same.
So a critter movie, I mean, that's just like, it's all the good girls and boys. It's just dog palooza. You know, you can't not love it. But the other thing that in rewatching it and kind of thinking about it as a grown-up struck me is that most people have had the experience, especially as they get older, of maybe picking up a new hobby, sport, taking a class somewhere, kind of doing a thing to sort of to get away. I'm going to get away from all the craziness of my, you know, work or whatever, kind of being a grown-up. And that, you know, let's say it's ferrets or something, you know, then you discover that there are internecine ferret people feuds. And there's somebody who clocks that you're new wants to pull you in to like ex parte conversations about ferret gossip. And then it's like, so then it's revealed to you that internecine ferret feuds are life itself. Like you're never getting away. And that's what these movies, this kind of quartet of films, I think it is four of them, that Christopher Guest, Eugene Levy capture so beautifully about these endeavors that are superficially trivial to outsiders, but the people in them take them deadly seriously. So if you think you're going to have like a breezy time, it's just life. It's just regular life with people having weird agendas and feuds and stuff going on and trying to calculate the right number of kimonos to bring to Philadelphia and all that kind of stuff. So I think that now as a grown-up, because I saw it when I was pretty young, as a grown-up, that's the thing that really strikes me about it.
One of the things, speaking to what you had just said about sort of the background of this community, is on the highest ranked YouTube comment on under this movie is, the funny fact about this movie is there are really people who behave this way in the real world. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. This is something that I've gleaned from, partially from being a hobbyist figure skater, but mostly from being in and around the art world and specifically the craft world, where there are, you know, small studios and kind of struggling nonprofits and people who are valiantly, you know, keeping traditions alive. And it's something that it's almost like when people have a fantasia, like, I'm going to be an Eileen Fisher model and walk through the fields and I'm going to quit my job and I'm going to make pots. Like that, there's a very like powerful lure of kind of wanting to check, you know, just clock out of society and kind of wear linen and make pots. And then they land in the community and they're like, well, you're new here. I don't know who you think you are, but this is my wheel. You know, it's this very kind of like fraught, because
in marginalized communities, which a lot of these places are, it's something that people don't take seriously. They don't have enough money. They, you know, blah, blah, blah. You get a lot of that spiky experience in the place that you think you're going to not have that.
Mm-hmm. And like, there's a fantasy that like the margins of real life end somewhere and there's a place where the sidewalk ends.
Exactly.
But like, no matter where you go, people are going to be weird and intense and gossipy.
Yep. Well, and that's what's so wonderful about all the humans in Best in Show, that they're kind of as examples of type, like examples of breed.
Yeah.
They're sort of, you got like, you have the country guy and the urban guys and the lawyers and the, with braces, and, you know, that's a type, I guess, and the kind of complicated, rich lesbian trophy wife situation. And like, there's, you know, all these different kind of types of people that are, that exist in this world. And I do like to think that it is based on reality. I can't say for sure.
I think so. I mean, to some extent. I mean, I think what I love about this movie, and there was a period in 2020 when I watched it like maybe 12 times, you know, because it, when I would find something that like gave me some dopamine, I would just keep pressing the button until I got tired of it. And it's such a funny movie. It works so well and is kind of, I think, the best proof of concept of this format that we have, maybe. Mm-hmm. And it also is in its own way very optimistic. Like some of these couples, really all of these couples are good for each other, you know?
They have a lot going on in the best case scenario, which I guess I would say that who's the best case scenario couple? Is it like, is it the Flex?
I think the Vanderhoofs.
Maybe yeah. It's the Vanderhoofs. Yeah. Cause even there, yeah, there's a lot going on.
Yeah. But maybe, okay. So let's get into our story. In the late 90s, we were all so excited about mockumentaries. And I think in the same year, we got Best in Show and the Blair Witch Project. So we were very spoiled.
Oh, fascinating.
Right? Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
That's so interesting.
That has something to do with something.
Yeah.
Coming off Drop Dead Gorgeous, which is great.
Yeah. God. Oh, my God. And like, what an incredible movie. And also a perfect mockumentary. But so this is, you know, filmed very much like, you know how on Sentimental Garbage they speculate about what kind of documentaries Lisa Todd Wexley is making and just like that? This is the kind of documentary Lisa Todd Wexley makes. You find some groups of people to follow to a dog show. You get a lot of footage. You cut it down. I don't think hers would be as funny, but like it's that kind of format. And that you especially would see so much on TV in the 90s, or like, you know, local arts funding paid for documentaries like this.
Yeah. Remember there was also a movie about like people who do crossword puzzles. There was a whole suite of these.
Oh
like,
yeah. The Will Schwartz one. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. This was like before the internet came and told us how everyone is all the time. We had to like go and watch documentaries about it.
Right. Cause I hate to overexplain the 90s all the time, but it is a remarkable cultural shift that like, if I want to know what the lace making community is feuding about, I can just look it up. I can get that information in 3 seconds and someone will have done like a Drama Channel video about it. And I can spend like 57 minutes listening to it while I do dishes. And back then you had to just like wait for a local PBS affiliate to bother thinking about it.
Yeah.
Or you had to know people.
Yeah.
Like you had to go to a place and get amongst it.
Terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Terrible time. And I mean, you know, and I'm joking, sort of, but like it does feel like information is so abundant now that it doesn't feel as valuable in a way.
Yeah, oh, totally.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this thing, the like intimate look, like I remember my favorite version of this is the West Memphis 3 trio of documentaries?
Paradise Lost.
Paradise Lost, with just like the stepfather. Like, and there's like such like a character in that movie who you see this arc over time. And I remember that was like one of the first documentaries I ever watched where I was like, I need to know more about that guy and like how these people are or like whatever. And now that I can know how everyone is all the time, knowing the concept of knowing anybody makes me want to be alone.
Yeah. And there's so much information that you could find so easily, but you're just like, I don't really want to know. I'm tired of knowing things. I've learned so many things before breakfast.
I kind of feel like a dog show is the perfect vehicle for a documentary structured like this, because it's kind of like how, you know, like every 4 years, everyone is like, knows nothing about snowboarding. And then they're like, you know, 2 minutes later, I would die for XYZ athlete who's, you know, has a great backstory. Like there's not a lot of celebrities in the dog show world, even though it, you know, it comes on TV, you watch, it's like around, you know, whatever it is, Thanksgiving. So you can kind of project onto it. It's just this kind of stadium hall full of characters. You don't really know who they are. The judges are renowned in the field, but nobody knows who they are. And so it's the perfect canvas, even now, I think.
Oh, yeah. Every Thanksgiving.
Right.
And like inside of 3 hours, you like pick your favorites for no reason except that you like them.
They're so cute.
And you don't really look at the people, which is interesting, too, where it's when it's televised, it feels like it's really all about the dogs and the people are just these random like mother of the bride 1982 looking grown-ups who were, you know,
kind of hustling across the floor. Right. Yeah. Sneakers. Yeah. Like orthopedic shoes. And the camera is low because the dogs are low. So it really kind of like it trains your eye on all the little guys. And sometimes when watching like a real dog show, when the dog is small enough to be like put in the cup, that's my favorite. Like that's, you know what I mean? It's like a little, you know, a Shih Tzu or a Pekingese. They just kind of put them in there. Do they like it? That's the kind of big question.
They probably like it for a second.
This is the question Fred Willard has.
He's like, not wrong.
What's going on through these dogs' heads? In that, I hadn't even thought about that with regard to the positioning of this. Really feels like a Sarah Archer episode because we're 1 minute in and we are breaking down how this movie works technically, and that's amazing. But like I love that you brought up the thing about like the cameras being low because it's the dogs. Because like I had never even thought about the fact that the couple that Parker Posey is in, that we're opening with them in therapy dealing with the fact that the dog has seen them fuck, and it's so off-putting.
Well, she's seen them attempting to. We don't know if they were successful.
Oh my god.
And then that's us. Like we the audience are gonna watch the humans fuck for like an hour and a half, and it's gonna be extremely unsettling.
Right, exactly. I know. And poor Beatrice, so negative.
Poor Beatrice. So we our opening and ending of the movie is on our yuppie couple, Meg and Hamilton Swan, Parker Posey, who really got braces for this role.
Did she really?
She really did. God bless her.
Wow.
She's dedicated to the craft. And it opens with her talking about how they're seeing this very serious therapist. And they're like, Beatrice has been showing signs of depression. And you can't see Beatrice. So if you're coming to this movie fresh, which is, of course, impossible to do. Yeah. You're like, oh, they're talking about their child. And Parker Posey, like very unhappily recalls how she was getting into a position that was very difficult for me emotionally. It's called the Congress of the Cow.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And then we just like, you know, eventually pan over to Beatrice, who turns out to be this Weimaraner who is completely sprawled on a little chaise as if she's here for Freudian analysis. And like the sight gag of the camera panning over to Beatrice, who's just like very much a dog and just kind of like looks up a little bit, like, it's so perfect. It's a perfect joke.
It's so good.
And so we have five couples. This is also a movie about couples and relationships, which I think is so interesting. We have four couples and a singleton.
Right.
And I've read Christopher Guest talking about how he has often like cast himself in his own films as loners.
That seems to describe how everyone describes him, is that like he's a very like inside himself, difficult to access person, but like a very kind person, it seems like.
Interesting.
Anyone who's like gotten through seems to be like, he's extremely lovely, but like it seems like there's a couple protective crunchy outer layers.
Oh yeah, like a nut, if you will.
Yes.
But what kind of nut?
All natural pistachio nut, for instance.
Harlan Pepper, you quit naming nuts. Yeah, and so we're introduced to Jerry and Cookie Fleck, who are, of course, our great love story of the film, played by Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara. They live in Fern City, Florida, and Cookie is showing at like a very backyard-looking local dog show their dog, Winky, who's a Norwich Terrier. And I've also read that like the two of them developed a backstory for their characters where they had like befriended this old lady who left them a show dog, and that's why they have Winky.
Oh, that's great.
Oh.
And Winky is also, I'm going to go on a limb and say that in a rather intentional way, Winky is the dog with the most charm in this movie because, you know, dogs are generally fairly active, but based on just like the way we see the dogs in this movie consistently and the way that it's edited, I think there's an intentional emphasis on showing them when they're doing basically nothing, because so much of the story is about how much their owners are using the dogs as a proxy to describe their own feelings. And the dogs are just like, I don't know.
Like, can't find the toy. I don't care. It's fine.
She's freaking out.
Like, oh my God.
Which is what my mom is like with her dog. Oh. And understandably, but like, you know, there'll be times when she's super stressed about something. And she's like, Bo is so unhappy. And I'm like, you're unhappy. Bo doesn't know what's going on. Bo's thinking about dinner, you know?
That's so funny.
And maybe I'm wrong, but that, right? But that's such a thing that people do with their pets.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
So who do we have? We have Cookie and Jerry Fleck. And the dynamic that we set up is that before they met, Cookie had, Jerry says, she had dozens of boyfriends. And Cookie says, I did not know that. And so the whole movie is them running into her ex-boyfriends and Jerry being stressed about it. And that could be the whole joke, right? But again, like, all these characters feel so lived in. And like, when we're introduced to them, I love the moment where they're talking about meeting at a dance. He didn't want to dance because he has two left feet.
Literally.
Which he does, literally.
Incredible.
And he's like telling this sort of like funny, but like a little bit sad backstory about how when he was growing up, they used to call him Loopy. Because he walked in loops, but then with some therapy, I learned how to walk in a straight line. And then she's like, and dance. You've got moves even better than Winky, I think. And he's like, wow. You know, and just these like moments that feel very real and of tenderness between the couples. Like, it's rare to have that in this kind of a movie, I think.
Oh, extremely. They're not cartoon characters. Like, they really, I mean, they're wacky, but that's like real affection.
They have that really beautiful scene where he's describing how she wants to go hundreds of miles out of the way to meet some couple that they met a couple of years ago.
No, to meet her ex-boyfriend from before they were together.
Right. Yeah, thank you. And it gets tense for a second. And then she kisses him and she says, like, this is why it works. And it's so nice. I went back three times to hear her say, this is why it works. And I don't know why that stuck out to me. It was so sweet.
It's really great. It's really great that, like, the more you watch it, the more you kind of notice these little moments between the characters. And then we have Harlan Pepper, our singleton, who's played by Christopher Guest, name and nuts, who is from Pine Nut, North Carolina, and he has a bloodhound named Hubert, who, again, is projecting nothing.
He's such a love bug. Oh, my God.
Yeah. And then we have the Vanderhoefs, Stefan Vanderhoef and Scott Donlan in Tribeca. And they, again, like, I love their relationship. And they talk about, like, the backstory that Michael McKean, who plays Stefan, gives on how they met is like, you know, he was like at a party with his ex-wife, which is such a beautifully slipped in bit of backstory. And I saw his nibs over there. And I said, who's that? And she said, that's Scott. He shows a good dog, you know, and they started going out. They like the same things. And they're like, the great American love story writ large, us, you know. And I feel watching it that, like, it's not my place as not a gay man to come down ethically on having gay couples played by straight actors in the 90s. But it was what we were doing at the time. And this is the best that you can get, I think, from that.
I Googled a little bit to find out that the guy who plays Scott Donlan is straight. And I was it blew my mind.
Yeah. He later plays very like an extremely straight series of like smarmy characters on the Pitch Perfect series.
Yeah.
Huh.
It's mind blowing range.
Yeah. And all these people are chameleons.
Well, they have two Shih Tzu, right? They have like girl boy Shih Tzu.
Agnes and Tyrone.
And Agnes is a competitor and Tyrone is home watching old movies.
Yeah. What happened with Tyrone?
Yeah. What's going on? I don't know.
And then finally, of course, we have what I think of as like utopian Anna Nicole Smith fan fiction. We have Jennifer Coolidge in a really star-making role for her as Sherry Ann Cabot, who's married to a man who's 90 years old if he's a day.
Mm-hmm.
And Cabot is like such a Boston society name. So you kind of can easily infer like she's married into old money and she's very like, you know, lip liner outside the lips, kind of an aesthetic. They have a standard poodle and we meet her handler with whom she has a wonderful working relationship Christy Cummings, played by Jane Lynch.
To perfection.
Oh my God. Yeah. This is Jane Lynch's finest role, I feel like.
Yeah. What do you like about it?
It's so perfect for her. I mean, she kind of eventually does a version of this on Glee, but like, it's like more menacing, but like the like lived in, confident, quietly sexually aggressive lesbian that that makes people feel kind of ill at ease in a really great way. But feeling ill at ease because she's extraordinarily confident, but not loudly. There's like a weird quietness about her confidence. And I forgot, like one of those two guys says that she looks like a cocktail waitress on an oil rig.
Because it's the piping. Look at the piping. My favorite scene with her has got to be, she kind of saunters up to Harlan Pepper and Hubert.
Yes.
And
oh
then,
my God.
You know, chit-chatting about like this, oh, you know, slobber. They're such a cute, you know, cutie pie. And then like, I handle Rhapsody in White.
She is playing the game.
Yeah. She kind of like says, I handle Rhapsody in White. And this almost like
quasi-menacing.
Right. It's, yeah. It's like quasi. And he handles it so well. It's like, I mean, can you imagine like somebody sort of like, you're a minor celebrity in an arcane field. And then you kind of walk up to somebody like,
and you're like, listen, country boy.
Exactly. Do you know who I am?
You know who I am. And he's like, I do and I don't. I died. What do you say? I've seen this so many times, but for some reason that really got me, as I was like, I'm going to find a way to use that in my life. I do and I don't.
What do you think about the way that Harlan played that, Alex?
I love, you know, like, I think typically the dynamic with Jane Lynch is that someone who otherwise believes that they're confident in who they are gets undone by being sort of matched with her. Like, he's a guy who's going to really get into ventriloquism later. Like, so he's not undone by it at all. He's not embarrassed about not really knowing who she is. He just isn't quite sure what to do with her. And someone, another one of the comments on YouTube was like, a reason why this movie works so well. And I mean, this is such a simple explanation, but like, it really sort of got me thinking about it. It's like, the reason this movie and these movies work so well is you have these extremely interesting, quirky, strange, lovable characters who should understand when other people are being weird, but they find the other people weird too. And so you see the dynamic of like all of these people being weirded out by each other in some way.
That's so true. Yeah. That's like my other favorite one is the cocktail party scene where the Flex and the Vanderhoofs kind of bond.
Yes, I love that.
And Scott decides, it's like, well, listen to you all of a sudden. And it's like he's showing off his pants and the stitching. And it's like, yeah.
I know. Yeah.
Jerry's finding his voice.
He is. Yeah. And I love that, you know, because you spend so much time inside of a character while you're, you know, doing all of the hours of improv that get boiled down to this, it feels like you can't play a character that you don't in some way love or respect, I think.
Right.
If not respect, then certainly love.
I hate a movie where they don't.
Right.
And I only know it feels wise. Like, I know that I've seen a bunch of movies that do this, and like, maybe I just didn't even let them continue to exist in my psyche. But like, I cannot. And I have much less taste for it than ever before. Like, I can't stand a movie that presents even just like complicated, difficult, quote, bad characters without some love for them. I just have no interest in them.
And I don't think this movie does that to anybody.
No.
Even Fred Willard has like a couple of good ideas.
Well, no, he's asking good questions.
He is.
I just read Ed Begley Jr.'s biography, which was really lovely. And even he just has like, I think his character in this movie is Christopher Guest. Because he's watching them all and like, he does this kindness for him, which he absolutely doesn't have to do. And like, is like, he loves these people who he finds strange and maybe even kind of annoying because it's like interrupting the flow of what he's doing. But he's like, here's a room for you so you can do this.
Yeah.
And it's not an ideal circumstance, obviously, but like, I kind of get the sense that like, that is how Christopher Guest sees these people.
Yeah, that seems apt. Like, he's the host.
Right.
In the Mayflower, which sadly was not actually filmed in Philadelphia, I checked.
Boo.
Yeah. And is Philadelphia where they host the Westminster or whatever it is at Thanksgiving every year?
There's definitely, I don't know if it's Westminster, but it's definitely one of them. It might be like the National Dog Show, but I think it has been. Yeah.
I keep meaning to come to the Philadelphia, I think it's called the Philadelphia Miniaturia. show of that's a big miniature convention in the fall.
Oh shit.
Right.
Yeah. Let me know if you decide to do that. Cause yeah. I'm on it.
Well, and and you love minis.
Oh God.
Someday I'm just going to compile the most specifically Sarah Marshall quotes ever delivered. And that's one of them.
That's a good one.
I went to a miniature show in Portland at like the Monarch Hotel or something in 2019. And it was one of the most fun things I've ever done.
Didn't you cry? You cried, right?
I did. I'm sure I cried. Yeah.
I think that's incredible. Like these things that move us.
Yeah.
Who knows what it's pulling at, but like it's, I'm getting emotional.
Aw. Well, I am descended from jewelers.
Was it the craftsmanship? Like what was it that made you moved? Was it the dedication?
Part of it, I think, is that some of these scenes and places that people construct in miniature. And Sarah, you've told me some of what I know about kind of miniature history, because I remember what are the houses that like women would have?
Oh, yeah. The Popenhus, the doll. Yeah, there were these things called cabinet houses. And there, I think Popenhuis just actually means dollhouse in Dutch, which I'm probably pronouncing totally wrong. But it was kind of around the time of the tulip mania, sort of the Dutch golden age.
They just had too much money. They were having some fun.
They had like a lot of cash. Right. And they would sometimes, the women, there's one named, I think, Petronilla van Kort, I want to say, or van Ort. And you can see it online. If you Google, go to like the Rijksmuseum.nl or whatever it is.
Don't cut this, Miranda. It's crucial.
It's critical. And the thing that's incredible about them is that the women would sometimes hire life-size craftsmen, that not that the craftsmen were life-size, but that they made life, you know, brass chandeliers or Delftware.
Right. Like people who get it.
Right. So it's like,
it took me a second.
The real, you know, floor tiles, carpets, like all to kind of recreate things in miniature and create these incredible houses. And it was at a time when women couldn't own property in their own right. Mm-hmm. So they were able to kind of create these little dominions and become patrons of the art, but like 128th size.
Yeah. And I think part of what it makes me think about is temporality, right? That like, if I make a garden scene, I can do like a Twilight garden and the Night Blooming series is opening, and I can sort of capture a moment in miniature that in real life is extremely fleeting, but in miniature it can last forever and you can have the perfect place that you can never be inside of.
I think that's true of pets, honestly, too. I mean, that's the thing about like this way in which pets kind of take a snapshot of a phase of your life. Mm. It'll be like high school to grad school, or like when you first met your husband to being middle-aged or whatever, like that kind of bracket. They don't live, unless you have one of those turtles that like remembers the Civil War, like you don't have a pet that lives your whole lifespan. And so you're saying goodbye at every turn to this kind of slice of your past in a sense. And I think there's a way in which pets, in that they're literally small, but also that they're kind of like, they have these sort of miniature lives, right? Like they're kind of little, they have shorter lifespans. They kind of have a foreshortened world because they kind of live, you know, in your house. So there's certain parallels there.
Yeah. No, I love that. And then, yeah. And so they're all bringing their dogs to the Mayflower show, which is the big national show where they're going to crown the champion. So we have Winky, who, you know, the Flex are definitely our underdogs here. They show up to the hotel and don't have enough money to pay for a room. And so Alex, as you were describing earlier, Ed Begley Jr. gives them a room in the utility closet.
Yeah.
Yeah. His trying to soften the blow of every bad piece of information he has is so sweet.
I know.
Yeah. And so we have Rhapsody in White is our two-time former champion, and Christy clearly believes she's going to win again.
Odds on favorite. There's a big party to celebrate her with an ice sculpture.
Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah. We get to watch everybody mix, which is great. We get to see the Vanderhoofs and the Flex meet. And also we get to see Harlan meet the Yuppies, which I also love because we have them leaving Beatrice in the hotel room and Parker Posey doesn't want to go to the party. So they're like, Beatrice doesn't want us to go. And he's like, Mommy and Daddy will only be away for a little while. Not the lips, not on the lips.
Just like good riddance. Look at
that. I think that this is like Margot and Todd from Christmas Vacation are the best on-screen yuppies, I think. Mm. But this is, I think, my second favorite collection of yuppies on screen.
He was working on his Mac.
Is that L.L. Bean? Do you mind if I check the label?
Do you remember that there was a New Yorker cartoon like years ago, like around this time when like Starbucks was sort of like becoming a self-aware phenomenon? And there was a caption. There were like two people sitting in a cafe and it was the caption is like, are we at this Starbucks or the one across the street? Which I still find so funny. And I wonder, I've always kind of wondered if that inspired the whole like I was working on my Mac, you know, exchange.
Yeah. Honey, what's new? Yeah. And so, yeah, we're heading into the Mayflower. And then there's really this lovely, the structure, again, is very simple and I think works really well. And so halfway in, the narration is kind of handed off to Fred Willard and Jim Pittock, who are our color commentator and our straight man commentator for the Mayflower.
Perfection.
And watching the other commentator, the non-Fred Willard commentator, whose name is escaping me.
Trevor Beckwith.
Watching Trevor Beckwith's patience gradually be eroded is incredible.
Fred Willard makes some like off-color joke and Trevor Beckwith's like, yes, I believe you said that last year. Very quiet. It's so good.
That's so brilliant because like you're the whole time you're like, how's he dealing with this? And then you're like, oh no, he's had to deal with this before. It's so funny. But then when Fred Willard notices the two left feet and then Beckwith is like, I can't believe I'm saying this, but I think that you're right.
And then like the big, you know, the line about ham too. It like when Beatrice loses her shit totally understandably.
Yeah.
Because she's had it with the swans and the whole, the all of it. I think this is best of breed.
Yeah, she gets disqualified like immediately.
Immediately, and his Fred Willers, he's going after her like she's made out of ham. So, the poor woman. But it was kind of accurate.
Yeah, and you know, and so we're heading toward our conclusion, but I feel like, you know, this movie happens in great parts and like legendary moments. And I would love for you two to just toss out, like, what did you enjoy about this ride, you know?
Oh, man. You go first.
We do have to talk about Busy Bee at some point.
Okay, can I tell you that of all the quotable things in this movie, my husband is one of those people who is real good on, like, dates and times and knowing, you know, getting on the road on time and knowing whether we're in Pennsylvania or New Jersey at any given time when we're in the car.
What Starbucks you're in.
Exactly. Well, he knows what Starbucks we're in at all times. So what, on occasion, I'm a freelancer. This is, you know, calendars are not my strongest suit. I'll ask him what may seem like a very obvious question. He'll sort of say, like, it's Tuesday, baby. I'm just like, what are you, a wizard genius? To my mind, like, he is a wizard genius because he's just like, you know, he's such a way for knowing. But so that is the sort of quotable moment for me. That and this is a bear wearing a bee costume.
Yeah, watching them unravel is beautiful.
Oh my God. Unravel is the perfect way to describe it. She's just absolutely, and the poor thing, she's doing her best. And what's his face? You know, Hamilton Swan is just being a dingus.
Yeah. Meg has gone off to get Busy Bee. And then Hamilton is like in the poor dog's face going, don't look at the fat ass losers and freaks. You look at me.
He's a show mom.
The best. Oh, he's totally a stage mom.
And it's like, gee, I wonder why she's stressed.
Yep. Poor Beatrice.
It's so funny. I've graduated from all my time on newspapers.com to going to archive.org and just looking at all of the sort of random archive stuff. But the one of the things that I really enjoy, speaking of this, and I hadn't even put two and two together, is there was a whole 80s and 90s genre of video, which was just the convention recap.
So there's
an early Fangoria magazine convention recap.
Wow. Ooh.
It's like an hour long video that I imagine what happened was you went to the convention and you gave them $20 and they took your name and address. And like in a couple weeks, they edited together and sent a video that recapped the convention. And you get sort of all the stars talking about one thing, the stars being like Robert England and like whoever, like talking about stuff. And then you have fans talking about why they like the genre, and then you have like whatever. And it's just people who feel maybe awkward in other parts of their life, but feel like very at ease in this group and sort of circumstance and environment. And there's something I like about the fact that like there's so many shitty things about the quote modern times, mm-hmm. but I like that we agree that if you really like something, we all get together like once or twice a year. Yeah. If you can sort of swing it, get in a big room with each other and like the thing together. I think that's like an extraordinarily lovely thing.
It is.
Until like fan toxicity gets into it. But it's like really nice when people are just like, let's just like the thing together.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, and you know, especially when it's mostly adults.
Yeah.
Things often go pretty well. Not to give adults too much credit, but like, right. I look at the things teenagers are upset about. And a lot of it is very real. And then some of it, I'm just like, you're not going to care about this in a few
years.
You just have too much energy.
Yeah. Yeah. You do. Like, you need to be run around a track. Like a Weimaraner.
Yeah. By Scott Donlan.
And then there's this wonderful moment where, like, Jerry has to step in mm-hmm. because there's a crisis.
Yeah.
Before everybody wins Best in Breed, except for Beatrice, who's disqualified.
And when Rhapsody wins Best in Breed, we do get something I quote a lot, which is that Sherry Ann, who has been eating popcorn by herself, waiting for another message from herself, sees that Christy and Rhapsody have won again. And we see that on the TV coverage, they're just fully
having a smooch.
They go for it. They're having a big old smooch, a Hollywood kiss. And Stefan is like, hello, Rhapsody has two mommies.
The best. And like, I think it's when the Shih Tzu wins the best toy. Mm. Scott is like, group schmoop, bring on the formal wear.
Group schmoop.
Formal wear. I just, it's like, it's Miss America. I love it.
And then I love that like, Stefan is like, what do you need or whatever? He suggests something. And Scott is like, bath bomb immediately. And I'm like, that's a good couple.
Yeah, they know each other. Gotta get changed.
Those guys, I love their relationship.
Yeah.
Like every time... Who is not Michael McKean? We were just talking about him.
Michael something Higgins.
Yeah. Every time he says something like slightly off, I know that couple. Several.
Totally. Oh, totally.
Where like one says something slightly off color. The other one's like, you're awful. And they're like, but still loves it. Like, is their best audience? Is their mm-hmm. most enthusiastic audience?
Mm-hmm.
And that couple is Palm Springs Modernism Week. Like you want to meet them in real life. Like every February, you're nice. Like, oh, you. Like you're going, like, it is perfect. It's pitch perfect. And it's so like, it's also really sweet, which is such a kind of like fun contrast. Because it's also, you get the sense that like Scott is probably kinkier, maybe.
Oh, sure.
Oh, yeah. He's wearing at one point, like as a necklace, something that looks like it's part of like a harness or a ball gag, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that.
And the way he sizes up Ed Begley Jr. Yeah. What are you from Norland? What are you?
Yeah. And just you can see, like, even if it's not explained, you can see the symbiosis happening there. And I also love that this is a movie with four couples, two are straight, two are gay, and we kind of have a functional and a dysfunctional one of each.
Right. Yeah. What do you make of Christy and Sherry Ann?
I guess they're not communicating.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm really happy for them, but like...
There's like the weird makeup thing.
But right. And just at the very end of the movie, the kind of great advancement of the dog show is that they are now able to be open about their relationship. They're running a magazine together, American Bitch. For the lesbian purebred dog owner.
We didn't win Mayflower, which was surreal.
Well, yeah. And I feel like what worries me, and I get that it's they're in a documentary, but that they're like being all cute about being, I think they're trying to make it like, yeah, now we're in a relationship now. We weren't before, but we are now.
And what happened to the husband?
God knows.
Oldie McGee from the Conan O'Brien show. That guy played a recurring character in Conan O'Brien show like pre-year 2000 called what? Oldie McGee.
Wow. God, well, he must have been pretty old. Gosh.
He was also in Old School.
Wow.
I remember that.
Oh.
Yeah. I imagine he's no longer with us.
You know, you just never, maybe he had a heart attack when he saw them kissing on TV. I choose to believe that. But yeah, and so they're talking, Christy's like, and it turns out she's a great in the sack. And Sherry Ann's like, likewise, I'm sure.
I feel like that, I know that like her turn in Legally Blonde is really what blew it up. But like that feels to me like her star turn. When she says that in particular.
Yeah. And so I feel like Sherry Ann, like, they've kind of just brought their relationship out of the closet. Like, I think they have some growing pains. They need some time to... But, you know, but that's okay. And then also the yuppies are like, well, we'll get to that later, but they're in a much better place because Beatrice was so negative.
So negative. And it's just so great that she's not around anymore.
She had a lot of problems.
I bet Beatrice is like thrilled wherever she ended up. Oh, she's
Beatrice does not have to deal with these people any longer. But okay, but Sarah, take us home. So we're up to everyone's one best in breed except Beatrice, who's so negative.
Except Beatrice, who's gone. So we've got the four finalists in, you know, hound, toy, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And Cookie, who is normally the handler for Winky, theatrically twists her knee in some incredible way that Catherine O'Hara then is like limping, but it's like wiggly. Like she's kind of doing this, like, it's incredible. Yeah. So she can't go on. It's a crisis. And then Jerry has to show Winky. And he's like, well, I have two left feet. I've never done that. I don't know how to do this. And everybody's like, Christy, I think in a little bit of a menacing way, but everybody else in mm-hmm. kind of a sweet way is like, we'll help you. So you can totally do this. You got it. You've seen me do it before.
It is lovely watching everyone rally, especially Scott.
I know. It's kind of like the Great British Baking Show.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
I think, like, in large part, because no one thinks he's going to win.
Right. They're like in the broom closet. He has two left feet. She's like limping around. But the dog, you know, hits it out of the park. It's very competitive. It's as Trevor Beckwith intones. It's a hard decision for the judge, right? And I think this is probably true. I think that would be one of the hardest things because you're not comparing, you are quite literally not comparing apples to apples. You're mm-hmm. comparing apples and pears, right? If you're comparing dogs. And Winky is the Grand Prix winner and Jerry is dumbfounded. They are completely awestruck by winning the Mayflower. Christy Cummings is not happy. She's visibly disgusted with this outcome. And he kind of holds Winky aloft and Winky kind of like gives side eye to the camera and they capture Winky on camera, kind of pulling this face that is just like, I don't know how they captured that. It's perfection.
It's incredible.
And then, you know, and then we have our kind of Guffman style, you know, 6 months. Is it 6 months later? A year later, 6 months later, what everybody's up to. And we've got the Vanderhoofs doing their like MGM movie palace calendar with the Shih Tzus. And it's, I guess it's, what's the girl dog's name? It's Tyrone and Agnes.
Tyrone and Agnes. And they're acting out the great love stories. And my favorite thing of that is that they've chosen as one of the great love stories, McMillan and Wife.
It's incredible. It's incredible. It's just, and it's, I would buy it. It's like, they're just, oh, we're just doing this for fun. Oh no, you have to sell it because I would buy it.
And again, it's so great because Tyrone and Aggie are just like standing there. Just not doing anything, which you want if you're shooting a calendar, but they're just these cute little mops.
They're little mops. They have beautiful, shiny hair. There's like faux fire in the background. I think, is that from Gone with the Wind? It might be. Yeah,
they're doing the Burning of Atlanta.
They're doing the Burning of Atlanta, and the dogs are just, you know, calmly, as certainly they would be in that situation. You've got, who else? There's Bitch Magazine, the periodical for the lesbian purebred dog owner.
Harlan is focused on the ancient art.
Harlan Pepper goes to a kibbutz and then decides to become a ventriloquist or realizes his previously expressed dream of becoming a ventriloquist. And it seems from the performance he gives that it's not going great. It's relatively small audience. The audience seems rather perplexed and underwhelmed, but he nevertheless is, you know, he does a rodeo routine.
Again, you can like kind of imagine a lot of backstory here. And I love things because he's like performing. It's performing at a VFW hall. He's got like a lasso and he's performing with his dummy.
I mean, you feel like they'd love that, right?
Right. And you picture, you kind of think that you'd be like, yeah, I'm doing something nice for the community. And it's like, haven't these veterans been through enough?
Well, it reminded me a lot of the Eugene Levy coda in Waiting for Guffman, where he's performing.
Oh, sure.
It's like a nursing home or something. And everybody's like, oh, God.
Right. That is a thing that they do in these movies, which there's a theme there.
It's the only thing that I'm not going to say it feels mean because I really don't think any of this ends up feeling mean. Mm-mm. But like there is a acknowledgement that a lot of the people that you know around you who have no shame or inhibition about how they express themselves and just like have a desire to do it no matter what can sometimes be unaware of how they're taking up your space and community space.
Oh, yeah.
And so, like, I think that that's, like, kind of what is always very funny, or like, have no awareness about, like, how funny, like, in or out of context, like, where they've landed is. Mm. And I always enjoy that. And it's, like, the scene of them singing and recording the songs badly reminds me of where Dirk Diggler ends up at in the last act of Boogie Nights.
Oh, right, because it's the flex. Yeah. And then, of course, the AV guy recognizes Cookie because everybody recognizes Cookie.
Oh, my God. I'm growing right now looking at you, girl.
Bulge. His name is Bulge.
It's exactly. Perfect. Perfect. Yeah.
Bulge. That's like, that to me is one of the funniest jokes. It's like, that guy's name is Bulge.
It is pretty funny. And the fact that they've been like, they were on local television three times. She's proud to point out. So at every turn, she's proud of him. So she's like acknowledging all these dudes from her life. And also, I think she unironically adores Jerry. That's my take.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I love the part where they're at the cocktail party. And again, she runs into someone who she met in like Louisville in 1982 or something.
Right.
And he like goes on his way and she's like, I know where I am, Jerry. That was fun.
Who's my future? Which sounds kind of like she's talking to a dog. It's like, who's a good boy?
Who's my future?
Yeah.
Right. Jerry is kind of the terrier group.
Oh, for sure. Himself,
you know, and I love when she's showing off winking. She's like, and this group is all about attitude. And could he have a better attitude? A more happier to know ya
attitude. He's just, and Winky is a little doll baby. I love him.
Yeah.
I think that's the category of dog that feels most cat-like.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
To me, that size range. So it's relatable.
They're the size of a chunky cat. A terrier is like a nice fat cat.
Then we go back to the swans to wrap up.
Yeah, we end with the swans as we began, which I love.
And things are looking up for the swans. Things have been going well.
They're wearing colors.
Because they've gone through what's new.
They're shopping from the Bowdoin catalog now.
They've adopted a pug who we don't see until... What is the sequence of events she's describing?
It's the last shot we see the pug finally. And that their new dog, Kipper, doesn't mind watching them have sex. In fact, he even likes it.
And we pan down to the therapist's leg, and Kipper is going to town on the therapist's leg. And that's the end. And it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. So, okay. So, Best in Show, this little movie came out in
2000.
1999. 2000, you know, in there. Millennial. It's a millennial like us. And I really think that it's hard to overestimate how much it affected comedy and media and sort of what kind of humor we saw from then till now, really. But do you agree with that?
I certainly do. I mean, I think it was hugely influential for also just kind of people's sense of humor generally, like not necessarily people who work in media or make movies, but it just kind of that like funny verite thing, the wryness of it and the kind of detachedness of it. It was a vibe that felt kind of new at the time. And now it's just, you know what I mean?
So, I mean, I think like, you know, like the obvious predecessor to this is Spinal Tap. This is Spinal Tap.
Absolutely.
But like the thing about This is Spinal Tap is you need to kind of also understand British metal or the style of humor.
Right.
And so you need to not just like the package, but you need to kind of like one of the things about the package.
You need to kind of be anchored in it somehow. And with Best in Show, you can go in cold. Mm.
Totally. That and Waiting for Guffman and Mighty Wind. Mm-hmm. I cared a little bit less about the Movie Awards one.
For your consideration.
Yeah, I do think that like with those three or four Christopher Guest movies from the late 90s into the early 2000s, it invites you to enjoy the format in a way where it's not alienating if like the subject matter is alien to you.
Mm. Right. And then it also, I would argue, is like a predecessor to The Office.
Sure.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Sort of the deadpan, like live filmed cringe, which as somebody who was a teen in the 90s, I can tell you it was not.
Yeah. Cringe live on tape. That's the vibe.
Live on tape was not a thing. And now it has been a thing ever since.
Yeah.
So that's Best in Show.
So that's Best in Show.
Which I think is, I would dare to call it a masterpiece of a kind.
For sure.
I would definitely call it a masterpiece. And I think that like, you know, my understanding historically is that the masterpiece is that you train as an artist, you apprentice, and then when you do a work that kind of shows your skills and shows that you have achieved mastery. That is mm-hmm. your masterpiece. And then you take it around and show it to people. And they're like, oh, I see, you are a master. That is your piece.
This may be apocryphal, but one thing that I was told in grad school, it may or may not be real, is that the teapot was sort of the potter's masterpiece because it, because if you can make a teapot, you've shown that you can do all the elements. You can mm-hmm. attach a handle, you can make a lid that fits, a spout that pours, and a foot that rests.
Yeah.
And like the body that holds tea. So there's sort of, you've proved that you can do all the things in this one object. And I kind of feel like this movie almost does that.
Totally.
Like there's pathos, there's humor, there's cuteness, there's snark, there's, you know, it's not, I would say maybe aesthetically, like I don't get as much dog content as I would have liked, but apart from that, you know, you can't have it all.
Right. But it's not about the dogs, but it is about the dogs, but it's not about the dogs.
Right. It's the people in their competitive categories.
People in show.
Yuppies, fishing hole guys.
Yeah. Tribeca gays and
wealthy lesbians, Tribeca gays who go to the butcher shop and tease the butcher. It's all the types.
And I also, something that I didn't notice consciously until I was watching it just before we got on is that scene that we sang at the beginning where the Vanderhoefs are calling home to sing Tyrone his favorite song.
Tyrone!
Is that Michael McKean is singing this song and Scott next to him, like when he finishes singing, just like makes this noise that's like kind of a laugh and kind of just a sound of like, I'm so happy. We're all, you know, just the way it's like an expression of kind of the way you feel when you're a little bit overwhelmed by the abundance around you, I feel like. And I feel like there's just like all the texture and flavor of human experience is in here, you know, not tragedy, but, you know, the sunnier side of pathos.
So you're absolutely, the sunnier side of pathos is such a beautiful turn of phrase. And I think like,
thank you.
I'm not saying anything I haven't already said in this, but like, this is just it's a kind movie.
It is.
It's not only a masterpiece in sort of what he does, it's a masterpiece in like how to treat your subjects with love in a way mm-hmm. where you're not compromising bite or insight or saying something.
I'd kind of invite the audience to root for a deeply imperfect character because we all are, right? And it's like I found myself really like rooting for Jerry so hard, even though I know the outcome. I've seen the movie so many times. I'm like, yeah, like Winky in the cup, whatever. It's but every time I watch that sequence, it's so lovely the way, like how proud, it's great.
Yeah.
The other thing that works really well, and I think maybe doesn't work in movies now because we don't joke about suicide, rightfully, understandably. Mm-hmm. But like my two favorite jokes from this movie are one where
it's unconditional love.
Yeah, it's unconditional love. It worked for my family until my mom committed suicide in 81. And she just, it's so relatable because I think we three and people who listen to the show have been the people who just say something in a conversation and then realize it was too dark for the conversation.
Everybody's like, yikes. Yeah.
And she doesn't care. Like, and she's not doing it to be an edgelord. She just doesn't, mm-hmm. it doesn't register.
I don't think it occurs to her because she's just relaying it as though.
She's like, it worked until 1981.
And then the conversation, what is her ex-boyfriend, the guy from 10 Things I Hate About You? Was he a hostage negotiator? Like what is.
Well, he's a jumper negotiator. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a jumper negotiator. He says, you think they jump like rocks, but they don't.
They ricochet off the gargoyle.
They bounce off gargoyle.
It's so dark.
It's such a loaded statement because like you realize you actually do kind of think that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, if you've given it some thought, which I think most people are like, mm-hmm. And then he does kind of a blow by blow.
It's so.
And then isn't there a hostage situation with Winky?
With his kid. Yes, yeah. His kid takes the.
Yeah. And what I love too, like this movie, so much of it naturally is in the editing, and like we don't know how they got the kid and Winky down. We just cut away. It doesn't matter. They figured it out. That's not our business. On to the next thing.
Right. So, because Winky exists, so we know that Winky survived. We don't know what happened to the kid, but like Winky exists.
So, okay. I feel like my kind of closing question about Best in Show is that, like, one of the accidental themes of this conversation has been that we're all drowning in media all the time and it's exhausting. And that this was such a special movie in the moment it came out because it felt, you know, we'd seen Waiting for Guffman, we'd seen This is Spinal Tap, so it wasn't a brand new flavor, but it was a new flavor. And it was something that I feel like we were so excited to have and to experience. And just in terms of like the state of media, the state of comedy now, like, do we still need something like a Best in Show to remind us, I guess, that things are funniest when we see the humanity and the people that we're laughing at?
God, I think more than ever.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty grim out there. And I think it would be, I think more humanity, like as we live longer and longer and longer with social media and the internet and more of that kind of media, if it has an audience today, I hope it does. I think it does. But I think there's the internet has the paradox that it allows us all to connect. Like we all know each other because of the internet, right? Beautiful thing. But it also allows us to flatten people that we just dismiss, people that we disagree with or say like, oh, well, you must be a monster because, you know, and that's not great. And there's so much of that. And I do think it would be really lovely to have something, another, you know, another iteration of something like this.
Yeah.
Maybe with cats.
Well, and the thing, the difficult balance is loving them too much. Cause like, that's where like, I think The Office, I was like, I started to like, I don't care about Pam and Jim's long-term plans. Right. And it's like, when you start to like form like long attachments, it becomes like a little difficult, but I do like, I mean, I think that this is, we've seen a lot of this get replicated or honored in the past 20 years. I think Schitt's Creek is this. Like, I think like Abbott Elementary is this.
That's true.
Mm. Abbott Elementary is a gorgeous, big-hearted documentary style show in the spirit of The Office, being in the spirit of this. I think the things that do work, it's like you can be clever all you want, but if there is not heart, it is not going to last more than a little while.
Nope.
And I think like that is a thing that I recognize in all of us on this call and people who come on the show and people like listen to the shows is like intellectual interest and interest in like how humans are generally, but wanting space to do it in a way where it doesn't always have to be so absolute all the time. And actually that ambiguous space is what is the most beautiful. Mm-hmm. What's your take, Sarah? You posed the great question.
I agree.
You got to have heart.
Yeah, heart's great.
All you really need is heart.
And it's all about attitude. And could there be a happier to know ya attitude?
Well, there are a lot of dog dads in this movie. Hmm. There's no fathers. Is there a single father?
No, no human children. It's lovely.
Except for the head popping off like a grape guy.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
He's the only one.
We know that Larry Miller, is that guy's name?
Whatever his
we
name
know that Larry Miller is a father.
Yeah.
Who, in your view, is the daddy, Sarah Archer, of Best in Show?
Oh, man. I mean, it's got to be Christy Cummings, right? Mm-hmm. Jane Lynch?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
I mean, it's a tough call because there's a lot of candidates, but I think as she says, you know, Sherri Ann provides the unconditional love and she's the father figure. And I think that is imperfect and very well sort of formulated in the way that the two of them play those roles.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that.
I think that's a perfect choice. Mine is going to be, I'm going to zoom out a little bit. And this is just an excuse to talk about Ed Begley Jr.'s autobiography.
Love him.
I heard him interviewed on WTF 10 years ago. And every story he told, I was like, what? Like, he grew up in LA and knew every cool person in the 70s. Like, was like close friends with Harry Dean Stanton. Had a stint doing heroin. He just like had a crazy, like, and then you look at his face and you're like, that guy?
Yeah, like you would not, I mean, you'd think that he's from like Norland.
It is, it's truly, it's not like, you're not going to read it and be changed in any way. And it's like, not unlike other sort of.
Another great blurb.
Memoirs. But it's clearly written with love. And there's a lot of like great stories about like LA and Hollywood in the 70s and 80s.
Oh, that sounds great.
And he just went viral on TikTok the other day. He's been struggling with Parkinson's, but like he is notoriously a huge environmentalist. And he was the president of the Academy for years, or the governor of the Academy for years. And he for years would take the bus to the ceremony on the day.
Amazing.
Of. And there's a great video his daughter made of him, of them going on the bus together to the Academy Awards. So I just, I've always, anyone who was ever in Fernwood Tonight, just like I have massive affection for before I even knew them, because Roseanne would end up casting everyone from Fernwood Tonight. So all these people I have great love for and have since my childhood. And that extends to Fred Willard, to Martin Mull, to Ed Begley Jr. But I just love Ed Begley Jr. And I think he's a real gem.
Oh, he's a treasure.
He's a treasure.
Sarah, daddy time.
Well, it is all the dogs, of course. Some of these, I don't know if this is a multiple dog's name or just one dog's name. I'm going to do my best. So playing Beatrice the Weimaraner, we have Arrowcat's Echo Bar, Take Me Dancing. Playing Winky, we have Urchin's Brillo. Playing Hubert the Bloodhound, we have Quiet Creek's Stand By Me.
Urchin Brillo.
Mm-hmm. Playing Agnes and Tyrone, we have Rapture's Classic and Cimarron's Red Hot Kisses. And playing Rhapsody in White, we have, I believe, two different dogs, Brocade Exclamation and Does He Does It With Pizzazz. And that is spelled D-E-Z-I space D-U-Z space it space with space P-I-Z-A-Z. Desi does it with pizzazz.
Wow. I'm blown away by this knowledge.
That's fantastic.
I love words.
Boy, and dog people apparently do too. I mean, it's fascinating.
Yeah. And all these dogs did an amazing job, and all the background dogs and all the dogs yesterday, today, and tomorrow. It is also, it makes you think of, you know, who really knows where to get a supportive bra? Is a dog show handler.
Yeah.
That's who I need to be asking.
Architectonic, you might say. Yeah. Oh, I'm an expert on this. If you're a minimalist with big boobs, like you become like a real expert on like t-shirts and all of your supportive foundation garments, as Jim Gunn would say. So we'll discuss. Yeah.
And my daddy is also Sarah Archer, who has such a head for knowing. And you know all about cats and kitchens.
And bras.
And Santa Claus and trad wives and so many wonderful, terrible things. And I'm so happy you came back.
Thanks so much, Sarah.
Oh, it is such a pleasure. This was so much fun. And I hope everybody out there can talk and not talk just, you know, for hours. And you are the best in show.
Oh my God, that's so nice.
Group schmoop. Bring on the formal wear.
Group schmoop. Let's do it.
All right, you. That's it for this week's episode of You Are Good. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks to Sarah Archer for being here with us. Thanks to Miranda Zickler, our producer and editor, for making the show happen. Thanks to our founding and consulting producer, Carolyn Kendrick. Thank you, you, of course, for being here. Thank you to Fresh Lesh for providing the beats that make our episode sound so sweet. Thanks for finding us and following us on social media at You Are Good or You Are Good Pod. Thanks to Alyssa Onofrio, who recently had a birthday and who we adore, who edits videos to promote each of these. You'll see those coming back soon. We just had a little break in video production, but those are coming back soon. Look out for those on the socials. Thanks to everyone who supports us on Patreon and Apple Podcast subscriptions. You make the thing possible. We all appreciate you, because this wouldn't be happening if you weren't supporting in the way that you are. Thank you. I think that might be it. And until next week, please don't forget that you, my friend, are good.